On Sunday evenings, we've been talking about the Bible's doctrine of total depravity. The Bible teaches that human beings, ever since Adam's fall, have been depraved. They've been twisted, spoiled, ruined by sin. The Bible teaches that human beings are wicked. They are bad. The Bible teaches that they are totally depraved. That every part of our being has been ruined and spoiled by sin. Our bodies, our minds, our imagination, our conscience, our will, every part has been spoiled by sin. And the Bible teaches that every human being left to himself or herself would commit every sin. Quite simply, there is nothing good in any human being by nature now. Yes, human beings do good things. They say good things. They sometimes have good thoughts. But the reason why is not that those things are natural to human beings, but that God moves those human beings from without, from outside, to act in a way that's good and talk in a way that's good and to have good thoughts and sometimes good feelings. Left to themselves, human beings would do evil all the time, and they would do nothing but evil. If God just withdrew his good influences from people, if he just let them act naturally, then they would be evil totally and completely and all the time. This is the plain teaching of the Bible. We've gone through passage after passage, and one verse we've quoted again and again is the Bible's description of the human race in the days of Noah, when God did just let people alone to behave naturally. And this was what happened. The Lord saw that every inclination of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil all the time. You leave human beings to themselves, and what do you get? You find that human beings think in a way that's evil, and they feel in a way that's evil. Every inclination, every direction their minds and hearts move is evil. Every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. Paul sums it up in a sentence in the New Testament when he looks at himself and he says, I know that nothing good lives in me. That is, in my flesh. And by his flesh, he means his natural self. He says that left to myself, nothing good lives in me. That is the Bible's teaching, that left to ourselves, unless God, as it were, injects some good inclinations into us from outside, left to ourselves, there is nothing good to be found in us. Human beings by nature have no desire for God. Human beings by nature have no willingness to turn to God. They've got no open-mindedness, no intellectual honesty when it comes to thinking about God. Human beings left to themselves will never search for God. What do you find in human beings naturally? Only total, stubborn, vicious hatred against God. The only determination, the only desire that comes naturally to human beings is a desire to blot God out of existence, to abolish God, to stop him from being God. The only thing that human beings ever love when they're left to themselves, to their own nature, they love their own sin. Human beings naturally just have no desire for anything good. They don't want to be pure. They don't want to be truthful. They don't want to be clean. They certainly don't want God. They don't want anything to do with God. By nature, human beings love darkness. That's what Jesus said, isn't it? He said that they love darkness. Even when light is there, shining, they don't want to be in the light. They would rather live in the darkness of sin. They love what's filthy. They love what's dark and disgusting. That's what human beings are like by nature. That's what all human beings, children of Adam, are like. Thank God there was one human being who was different. One human being born and by virgin birth. One human being who never inherited that dark inheritance from Adam. But Jesus Christ apart, every one of us was born in sin, shapen in iniquity, and the sin in which we were born was total. This has been the teaching of Christianity, Bible Christianity, all down through the centuries. Nowadays, if we say such things, people think we're saying something extreme and strange and a bit tasteless. They feel that what we're saying is offensive. But what we're saying is only what Christians who've known their Bibles have taught all down through the centuries. This is Article 9 of the 39 Articles of the Church of England. This is the official standard of the Church of England. Original sin. The sin we have from our origin. Original sin is the fault and corruption of the nature of every man that naturally is engendered of the offspring of Adam, whereby man is very far gone from original righteousness and is of his own nature inclined to evil, so that the flesh, his natural self, lusts always contrary to the Spirit, to the influences of God's Spirit. And therefore in every person born into this world it deserveth God's wrath and damnation. That is what every Church of England minister is supposed to believe and preach. That human beings, all of us, by our very nature, are inclined to evil, and that by our very nature we deserve God's wrath and damnation. This is the French Confession of Faith, and the official confession of the Reformed Churches of France, 1559. We believe that man was created pure and perfect in the image of God, and that by his own guilt he fell from the grace which he received, and is thus alienated from God, the fountain of justice and of all good, so that his nature is totally corrupt. And being blinded in mind and depraved in heart, he has lost all integrity, and there is no good in him. And although he can still discern good and evil, we say notwithstanding that the light he has becomes darkness when he seeks for God, so that he can in no wise approach him by his intelligence and reason. And although he has a will that incites him to do this or that, yet it is altogether captive to sin, so that he has no other liberty to do right than that which God gives him. Do you see what that confession of faith says? It says, yes, man has a will. Human beings make choices. The will incites a man to do this or that. But is that will free? Can a man naturally choose to do what's good? No. His will is altogether captive to sin. That the human will can only do what sin pushes us into doing. So that man has no other liberty to do right. Man is simply not free to do right, except that which God gives him. If God moves this sinner to do things that are good, then the sinner will do them, because God can push him into right. But left to himself, man is trapped, enslaved by his own sinfulness. And then this from perhaps my favourite catechism, the Heidelberg Catechism, great German catechism of 1563. Question number four of the catechism asks about God's law and answers the law of God is summed up in the two great commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. You shall love your neighbour as yourself. Then question 5. Canst thou keep all this perfectly? Answer, no, for I am by nature prone to hate God and my neighbour. By nature, I'm set to hate God and my neighbour. Question 6. Did God create man thus wicked and perverse? Answer, no, but God created man good and after his own image, that is, in righteousness and true holiness, that he might rightly know God his creator, heartily love him, and live with him in eternal blessedness to praise and glorify him. Question 7. Whence then comes this depraved nature of man? Answer, from the fall and disobedience of our first parents, Adam and Eve, in paradise, whereby our nature became so corrupt that we are all conceived and born in sin. Question 8. But are we so far depraved that we are wholly incapable of any good and prone to all evil? Answer, yes. Unless we are born again of the Spirit of God. It lays it out so simply and so powerfully. The question, is it really true? Are we so depraved that we're incapable of doing any good? Are we really prone to all evil? And these Bible-believing Christians of the past said, yes, that's the fact. That's the truth. Unless a man's born again of the Spirit of God, then he is totally incapable of doing good, of seeking God, knowing God, loving God, doing anything that will please God. It may be now a very shocking doctrine. It may be that people in the world aren't even aware that Christians do believe this. But the fact is, this is what Christians, Bible-believing Christians, have always believed. because it's there plainly in the Bible. It's there plainly in the teaching of Jesus. And it's there plainly in our own hearts. In the end, when we read these things from the Bible, when we read these things from the great confessions of faith, we don't, if we are real Christians, find ourselves saying, oh, but this is a little over the top. This isn't the way I feel about myself. Rather, we read these things and say, yes, that's what I find in myself. That's why I came to Christ, because I had realized that there was nothing good in me. That's what drove me to him. Well, here then is the Bible doctrine, believed by Christians all down through the centuries. Now we asked ourselves this question. Why is it so important that we believe this doctrine, that we teach it, that we remember it, and keep it in our minds? Why is it so important? Why is this a vital doctrine? And so far I've given you three answers. I've said it's vital theologically, and I've said it's vital evangelistically, and I've said it's vital practically. That's what we were talking about last time. I tried to show you that once you lose sight of this doctrine, it affects the way that you view every practical situation. Tonight I want to add a fourth thing. This doctrine is vital in terms of our spiritual experience. It's vital in terms of our spiritual experience. In other words, it's devotionally important. A person, a Christian, who gives this Bible doctrine its proper place, a Christian who is clear about this doctrine, a Christian who refuses to sort of push this doctrine under the carpet, such a Christian will find that his own spiritual experience is affected in the most direct way by his understanding of these truths. I've listed five ways in which this Bible doctrine shapes our spiritual experience. Firstly, this Bible doctrine is the basis of assurance. This Bible doctrine is the basis of assurance. We read earlier from Romans chapter 5. And Romans 5, the first half of the chapter at least, is all about assurance. How do I know that God loves me? And how do I know that God will carry on loving me? How do I know that God won't stop loving me? There are times when you look at yourself and you discover that you're very unlovable. And there are times when you realize how badly you've let God down. There are times when you see again just how much sin there still is in you. And there are times when you feel utterly ashamed of yourself. And you wonder, can God carry on loving somebody like me? Can he be loving me right now? Can he be loving me today, at this moment? The sort of person I am. That's the question Paul's answering in Romans chapter 5. And do you see how he answers it? He answers it in verse 6. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. And then in verse 8, God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And then in verse 10, for if when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son. Paul says, remember that when God chose you, and when God sent his son to die for you, and when God brought you to himself and made peace with you, he didn't do it because you were lovable. He didn't do it because he saw anything good in you at all, because there wasn't anything good in you at all. You were powerless. You didn't have strength to do one good thing. You were sinners. Your whole record was one of sin and failure. And you were enemies. You were in a situation of warfare against God. You were actively making war on God. And God saved you when you were like that. God loved you when you were like that. God loved us when there was nothing lovable about us. God loved us when there was nothing attractive about us. God loved us when there was nothing in us to make him love us. So what now could God find out about us that would stop him from loving us? At the point when God chose to love us, he knew that there was nothing good in us. At the point when God sent his son to die for us, he knew we were incapable of doing any good thing. At the point when God made peace with us, he knew that we had set ourselves to be his enemies. Do you see? When Satan comes to me now and says, you know, I don't think you're good enough for God to love you, I can turn back to Satan and I can say, God chose to love me when there was no good in me. God's love for me is not dependent on anything in me. God's love was given freely to me when I was totally depraved. You see Paul's argument. He says, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we've now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if when we were God's enemies we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? God wanted me when everything in my nature was black and filthy. God wanted me when he couldn't find one scrap of goodness or willingness or openness in me. God was willing to send his own son to the cross when all he could see in me was hellish hatred and viciousness and pride. Well, now that he's made me his child, now that he's taken away my enmity against himself, is he now going to say, well, I don't think you're worthy of my love now? He didn't love me because I was worthy of his love. He loved me when I was evil through and through. And he's not going to stop loving me now. When Satan comes and points at particularly gross sins in my life, and I can say, not just those gross sins, but every gross sin was there in my heart when God chose me. You see, it's the doctrine of total depravity that we need in order to have a well-grounded assurance. You might think that dwelling on our own sinfulness would undermine assurance, but it's not true, it's the other way around. It's only the fact that we understand what we were. When God chose to love us, that's the guarantee that he'll never stop loving us. And then secondly, this doctrine of total depravity is the foundation of true humility. Several times in talking about this doctrine, we've read together Ephesians chapter 2, where Paul is just reminding the Christians of Ephesus what they were by nature. "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins." You used to live in transgressions and sins. You followed the ways of this world. You followed the ways of Satan, the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who now controls those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among the disobedient at one time. We gratified the cravings of our flesh. We followed its desires and thoughts. We were just like the rest, by nature, objects of God's wrath. He's saying, have you forgotten? Have you forgotten what you were like? Have you forgotten how depraved your lifestyle was? It was totally depraved. Your whole life was one of transgressions and sins. Have you forgotten how helpless you were? You were dominated, enslaved by this world and by Satan and by your own evil nature. Have you forgotten how completely your system was spoiled by sin? Your desires and thoughts were all dominated by sin. Have you forgotten that your very nature cried out for God's anger? You are objects of wrath by nature. Remember those things, he says. But why is it so important that they should remember them? Because it's only as you remember those things, verse 8, that you understand this. It's by grace you have been saved. You didn't do anything to deserve salvation from God. You couldn't do anything. You were incapable of lifting one finger to win salvation for yourself. You really were totally helpless. You weren't saved because you were willing to be saved. Because you weren't willing to be saved until God made you willing. You weren't open-minded. You weren't searching. You weren't a person with a right disposition, as my Jehovah's Witness friends put it. You weren't any of those things. You were just a totally depraved person. So if you're saved today, then it's by grace you've been saved. Yes, through faith. But even that's not from yourselves. It's the gift of God. You weren't capable of believing. You weren't capable of reaching out to God in faith. All you wanted to do was to push God away. You didn't trust him. You couldn't trust him because your heart was blind and dark. See why it's so important that they should remember what they were. As they remember what they were, they realize that it must have been all by grace. That it must all have been God's gift to them. Not by works, so that no one can boast. See, that's where Paul's been leading this whole discussion. He wants to bring Christians to the point where they're incapable of boasting at all. Where they say, no, everything I enjoy, all my hope of salvation, it's all God's gift to me. I've not done one thing to deserve it. You know, if we had contributed something to our salvation, then we'd have something to be proud about, wouldn't we? You know, if I had made myself willing to be saved, then I would look at all the unwilling people out there and I would say, stupid people. I'm different from them. You know, I mean, they're so stupid, they're not even willing to be saved. But at least I had the sense to see that I ought to turn. I'd have something to boast about, wouldn't I? If I had had the desire in myself to seek for God, then I would be sneering at the people who don't seek for God. I'd be saying, look at them, so worldly, so depraved, that, you know, they can't even search for God. But I'm different from them. And Paul's saying to us, look, you're no different. You would be in hell at this moment if God hadn't chosen to have mercy on you. The only person who's going to get any praise is not me, it's God. Oh, through all eternity, I'm going to be singing about God's grace. Not about the fact that he managed to find a little bit of willingness in me, or a little bit of good desire in me. He didn't. He saved me despite myself. And so for all eternity, I'm going to be singing about this amazing God who chooses totally depraved people. People who hate him and turns them round and rescues them and makes them new. I'm not going to be singing in heaven, in the world to come, in all eternity. I'm not going to be singing, thank you, Lord, for the 98% that you contributed to my salvation. I'm congratulating myself on the 2% that I contributed. I'm going to be praising him for the whole salvation, the 100% salvation, which he carried through. He chose me. He bought me. He drew me. He overcame my reluctance by his infinite and infallible power. He made me a new creature. So secondly, this doctrine is the foundation of real humility. It strips away from us any thought that we've got something to boast about and leaves us boasting in God alone. And then the third aspect of our experience. This doctrine is the foundation of a proper carefulness. A proper carefulness. Suppose that you had someone who had been an alcoholic. Their life has been dominated by alcohol. They've been enslaved by alcohol. And perhaps they were like that for many years. And then somehow they escaped from alcoholism. For a year, for 5 years, for 10 years, they live free from alcohol. In all that time, they just don't take a drink. At the end of 10 years, they're still conscious of something. They're conscious of the fact that they've got to be careful. They're conscious of the fact that there is still within their system the potential for the old addiction to break out again. They're conscious of the fact that woven into their psychological and physical chemistry now is a hidden, buried lust for alcohol, which could erupt again like a volcano and seize hold of them again. That's why they're careful. That's why they don't go near their old drinking mates. That's why they don't step into the pub. That's why they don't keep a bottle in the house. That's why they stay as far away from situations where they could be attracted to alcohol as possible, because they're careful. A Christian has been delivered, rescued from sin. And yet we know that that old nature, the nature that once ruled us and dominated us, the remnants of it are still there. Listen to what Paul writes in Galatians. He says this. He says, I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. The flesh means the person they once were by nature. Well, in one sense, that person no longer exists. They've been saved. They've been remade. But he says, in another sense, the person you once were, your natural self, your flesh, is still there. He says, the flesh desires what's contrary to the Spirit, the work of God's Spirit. The Spirit desires what's contrary to the flesh, and they're in conflict with each other. So within every Christian, it's as if there are two people in conflict. There's the new person I've become, the person who lives by the power of the Holy Spirit, and there's the person I used to be, the person who by nature hated God and loved sin. There's still the remnants of that old person still there within me, and those are battling with each other. It's like the alcoholic saying, well, I'm a man who's dry now. I'm a man who's sober now. I'm a man who's free from alcoholism now. But he knows that there's another man buried under the surface. The man he used to be, who's still got that desperate craving for alcohol. Well, that's the way we are. If we're Christians, yes, we've been set free from our past. The person I once was, that person's gone. Buried with Christ in baptism. But he's still there underneath, ready to break out again. And then Paul says this, the acts of the flesh are obvious. He said that Christians have still got that old man, the flesh, still there. Under the surface, inside. And he says, and the acts of the flesh are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions and envy, drunkenness, orgies and the like. These are the things that the flesh wants to do. These are the things that come naturally to the flesh, he says. And I've got all that still inside me. That's the scary thing in Paul's words. He's saying that in every Christian there is still something that is capable of breaking out into sexual immorality and into impurity and into debauchery and even into idolatry and witchcraft. There still. That's why Paul in Corinthians says, if you think you're standing, take care lest you fall. A Christian who forgets what human nature is capable of. Christian is so vulnerable because he'll start playing with sin again. he'll start thinking, well, I can afford to, you know, go to such and such a place. I can afford to read such and such a book. I can afford to mix with people. But a Christian who knows what sin is, and a Christian who knows the deceitfulness of sin, will say, I've got to be careful. Because I've still got all that ready to erupt within me. Paul talks about the deceitfulness of sin, and he warns Christians about the deceitfulness of sin. Sin once deceived you totally. But sin could ensnare you again. It could drag you down. And then a fourth reason why this doctrine is so important in terms of spiritual experience. It's important as the foundation of my hope. Of hope. There are times, if we're real Christians, there are times in our spiritual experience when we just feel utterly weary and fed up with being such wretched sinners. And we feel that we're making no progress. And we feel that we'll never be free from the battle with sin. We feel that we'll never really ever escape from the clutches, the clinging, the infections of sin, the unclean things which come into our mind the moment that we let down our guard. There are times when we just think, I'll never be a man filled with love and filled with truth and filled with beauty. You just feel that you're so far short of being what you want to be. And it's at that point that the doctrine of total depravity is such a help. Because you're able to look back and to remember what you were by nature. And to say, look how far I've come. Look how far I've been brought already. God called me as a person who hated him. I don't hate him now. I want him now. God called me when I was a person who loved sin. I don't love sin now. I fall into sin, and at times I choose sin, but when I do, I feel very miserable. I don't enjoy sin now. It's been a real change in me. When God called me, I was a person who wasn't really interested in fighting against sin. I am now. I feel at times I'm losing the fight, but I want to fight against sin now. I do desire purity. I do desire holiness. Do you see? You can look back and you can remember that there was a time when you were, there was nothing of godliness and nothing of rightness and nothing of desire for God himself in you. And if you can find one scrap of desire for God in yourself now, if you can find one moment of love for Christ now, if you can find one real fragmentary bit of desire for holiness, then it's a proof that God has already been remade you. Because those things haven't come naturally from inside you, have they? Because nothing good comes from inside you. God has done marvelous things for you already. And if he's already done those things, he will continue to do those things until finally he completes those things when we step into his presence. Listen to what John writes in his first letter, if you know that God is righteous, you know that everyone who does what is right has been born of him. So if you can find anything that is genuinely right in yourself, anything that is really coming from love for God, anything that is truly holy in yourself, if you can find in yourself any real hatred of sin or love for Christ, well, it's a sign that you've been born of God. It's a sign that you've got a new nature, that you've been born again. And then he says this: how great is the love the Father's lavished on us that we should be called children of God. And then he goes on to say this: dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Now, do you see the chain of the argument? John says, firstly, if you find anything of real righteousness and holiness inside yourself, it's a proof that you're a child of God. It's his nature, because it couldn't have come from your own fallen nature. It must be his nature that's been imparted to you. It must mean that you're a true child of God. But if you are a true child of God, then one day you're going to be completely like God, who is your real Father. When Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. The doctrine of total depravity. People think, oh, what a miserable doctrine. What a wretched, depressing doctrine it is. No. It's only when I see what I was that I understand what a miracle it is that I can find anything of true righteousness, purity, goodness, love for God in myself. And those things become the great proof then that the work is going to be complete one day, and that I shall really be holy as he is holy. So the doctrine is the foundation of assurance and humility and carefulness and hope. And finally, the doctrine is the foundation of love. I quoted these verses to you a few weeks back. You remember Jesus was at dinner with a proud Pharisee. A woman who had lived a sinful life came into the room. She fell at Jesus' feet. She wept over his feet. She wiped them with her hair. She poured perfume on his feet. And the Pharisee said, what sort of hysterical display is this? And what is Jesus doing, letting some vile woman like this touch him? And so Jesus began to tell them a parable. He told them about two men who owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed a vast sum, and the other owned a small amount. And he says neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more? And the Pharisee answered, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled. You've judged correctly, said Jesus. And then he went on to say, he who has been forgiven little loves little, but he who's been forgiven much has so many reasons to love. Our debts were not small. We hadn't just hurt God a little. We had trampled on God's feelings. We hadn't just insulted God a little. We had spat in his face. We hadn't just treated God with, oh, a little discourtesy. we had hated him, and we showed our hatred to him. And God, for Jesus' sake, forgave it all. He forgave me for being the sort of person who hated him. He forgave me for being the sort of person who wanted to kill him. He forgave me for being the sort of person who stood at the foot of the cross and laughed at Jesus. He forgave me for all of that. And that's why I've got to love him, isn't it? When I think about what he's forgiven me, I have to love him for it. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Saviour's blood? Died he for me who caused his pain? For me who him to death pursued? Amazing love. How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? Love compels love. There's a hint for you young men. If you ever want to win a girl's heart, then don't try to impress her by showing off how clever you are or how cool you are. Just let her know that you really love her. And who knows, you may find love igniting in her in response when she sees how much you really love her. She'll love you in return. Love is irresistible. Love compels love. Why do I love my Saviour? Because he loved me when there wasn't anything lovable about me. Why do I love my Father in heaven? Because he forgave me when my debt was huge and I didn't have a penny to pay back. The prodigal son comes back from the far country in rags. He's penniless. His strength has been burned out in the far country. He squandered everything. He stinks. The father runs and throws his arms around him. And the son wants to find something to offer the dad, but he's got nothing that's worth offering. The father just says, look, everything I've got is for you now. The best cloak is his. Sandals on his feet. Bring out the fatted calf. He pours out the most extravagant forgiveness and love on his lost son who's come back. I think that son is going to love him. I think the son is going to love him for all his days. That's what God's done for me. That's what God's done for you if you're a Christian. You stank. You stank of hatred and pride, cruelty and selfishness. Everything about you was stinking. Everything about you was ragged and filthy. And yet this father took you in his arms and he forgave you everything you'd done against him. I pulled you back into the family home and he spread out his blessings. Said they're all for you. Don't you think you ought to love him? Don't you find that you do love him? He who's been forgiven much, loves much. The doctrine of total depravity teaches us that we've been forgiven everything. And we've been forgiven freely. And that's why we love our Saviour.